Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, everybody. From Mr. Carruth to Jay Electronica, the radio is just a stereo, like a house ain't a home. This isn't just a show, it's a project. It's a benevolent community, a chance in a movement, a chance to stand for something. And as Kendrick Lamar had to say, the sky is falling, the wind is calling, stand for something or die in the morning. What are we going to stand for, folks? Bunch of news we'll get to today. Critical events in the presidency, critical events in the House of Representatives, all that stuff we'll talk about very soon. But wanted to jump right now to a guest who we have the honor of talking to at this very precise window. His name is Peter McLeod. He is the chair and principal of a project based in Canada that was focused on, I'm going to call it a democracy experiment, maybe he doesn't give it enough credit. Peter, can you hear me? I think you're at the airport.
That's right. Unfortunately, there are going to be some periodic announcements here, but I hope they're going to pipe down really quick.
Well, there'll be audio announcements, so we'll all be able to enjoy them, right? If you were in a movie, then we wouldn't be able to enjoy the movie. But in an airport, we won't enjoy the flight, but we will be able to enjoy the audio announcements, at least 20% of the degree that you will. Where are you flying to, Peter?
Well, I'm just headed up to Ottawa.
So I don't steal your thunder. Explain the project you've been working on to folks.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what we've been up to here on the northern side of the border. You know, you mentioned a moment ago that this seemed maybe like a democratic experiment. In fact, I think projects like the one we've been a part of are one of the most promising examples of a new way of involving citizens in the space between elections and helping to reinvigorate our democracy. I'll talk about what we've been doing by impaneling citizens, a bit like a jury here in Canada, to think about how we might regulate social media. But I want to assure your listeners that, you know, this isn't a one-off. In fact, over the course of the past decade in Canada, we've had about 50 of what are called citizens' assemblies that have been advising government from the local level to the state level to the national level on all manner of policy issues. And in Europe, the OECD has counted about 600 of these projects taking place over the course of the past decade. So really, we're on a bit of a tear, and it's why the federal government commissioned my organization to bring together 90 Canadians to have a very close look at how we regulate social media.
So you brought together 90 Canadians to form a citizen jury. The project here, or if I'm going to use your term, the project here, by the way, I think the only culturally appropriate area of the world that you can sort of enjoy with humor how someone speaks is maybe like Minnesota and Canada. And if that is culturally inappropriate, please correct me. But I enjoy poking at the difference between project and project. Move along from there. But anyway, here, the sort of movement is about democracy. How do we make it work? And I personally, and a lot of our listeners, are fascinated about the idea about how we can make democracy work, including alternative ways, including ways that aren't merely elections. We very often equate elections and democracy. But when you say citizens' assemblies, I think those citizens' assemblies weren't voted, right? How did you pick them?
That's a great question. And, you know, you keep pointing out my Canadian accent. I'm just going to start saying sorry to you.
No, it is I who am sorry. It is I who am sorry for being puerile in what I enjoy. It is I who am sorry.
Not at all. So here's the thing. You know, at a time when we often decry the fact that the public seems at best not so motivated, maybe even apathetic about political matters, we upend what I think is a very cynical story. We send out letters to randomly selected households, 10,000 of them at a time in every corner of the country. And we invite people not just to come out to a town hall meeting, not just to fill out a survey, but in this case, to give us somewhere between 60 and 80 hours of their time to work first online and then ultimately travel to Ottawa and spend 4 days in the company of other citizens drawn from every province and territory. And, you know, in the depths of the pandemic, we had more than 600 people volunteer. From that group, we randomly selected a panel of 42 Canadians that was balanced for geography and the demographics of the country. So we could credibly say that we had Canada in a room. And I always like to point out that because it's demographically balanced, it means it's 50-50 men and women, which is a good deal better than your Congress and our Parliament.
There are a lot of things better than our Congress. Let's be clear. I mean, it's better today than I feared it might be. But it's to be better than our Congress, I think there are various options. Please continue.
Well, you know, if you are going to impanel people in this way, and you're going to give them a very clear mandate, in this case, our Minister of Canadian Heritage, ask them to think about how best Canada could address what here are deemed online harms. So this is stuff like child pornography, serial harassment, the targeting of racialized and vulnerable people. It's about the fraud that people experience online. It's also about the imminent threats of violence. And until this point, you know, there's really been a regulatory vacuum. It exists in your country and ours. The EU has moved with its Digital Services Act to address some of this vacuum. But the government wanted to hear directly from Canadians, and not just top-of-mind opinion, because you and I and your listeners, I'm sure, all have quick solutions for all kinds of complex issues. But the purpose of a citizens' assembly is to give people the opportunity to become really well-informed and to hear from many of the experts that might be called before a congressional committee or a parliamentary task force, and to give them the space and time to make sense of the issue, to weigh their values, consider a series of policy proposals, and ultimately, and here's the test, speak with one voice to give a consensus view of what the right policy prescription should be. And in the case of our three citizens' assemblies, this process took place over 3 years, they proposed 30 or 40 very detailed and very consequential recommendations that I expect will be taken up in legislation by the minister later this year.
So the idea is to make a demographically representative, gather a demographically representative group of people, and then it's not direct democracy in the sense that somebody gets an email and clicks yes or no based on what the headline says. These folks are impaneled like a jury would be, informed, given instead of a trial, given information from experts on the subject, as you said, like what happened in a congressional hearing, but then perhaps not experience the same level of sort of lobbying electoral pressures as a member of Congress or a member of Parliament, yeah?
That's exactly it. I mean, the caliber of experts was really considerable. It was people like Jane Vinenko from the Shorstein Center at Harvard, a number of the leading policymakers in this field around the world and in Canada, and even our former national security advisor and head of our intelligence services. So for people who had been sitting at home one afternoon and the mailman came by and dropped a brown envelope in the slot, they'd opened it up, they'd read this invitation from their government, they decided to put their hand up. Luck of the draw, they were selected, and a couple months later, they find themselves sitting, getting a security briefing from our national intelligence services. It's really a demonstration, I believe, a demonstration of confidence in the public's ability to grapple with what are often very polarizing issues and be able to find, by working together and listening closely to each other, true common ground.
So a primary reason why people who love citizens' assemblies, who love sortition, who love sort of democracy by jury, as distinct from merely democracy by election. It's not just the ancient Greeks, right, who said something like elections are for plutocracy, lotteries are for democracy. But it is also that you can have a degree of expertise without, you can gather a degree of knowledge without sort of making decisions. You can make a policy decision, a citizen jury can make a policy decision without merely thinking through a power lens. The counter argument is, well, wait a minute, but don't we elect members of Congress or members of Parliament in fact, get that expertise? What any information you have that demonstrates that these people are actually up to the challenge, that they're knowledgeable enough, they're hardworking enough, they're smart enough, if they're, you know, sort of just any citizen who wants to do it?
Well, I would put their recommendations up against those that emerge from a parliamentary committee any day. And I think, that would almost speak for itself.
The proof of the pudding is in the eating. The work product is good.
Absolutely. The work product is first rate. And look, there's nothing so exotic about what we're doing here. Like I said, it's synonymous in many ways to a congressional hearing or parliamentary committee. Now, I'm not one of those people who believes that citizens' assembly should actually displace our electoral politics. I think there are any number of things that we can do. I know you addressed them on this show to strengthen the caliber of our electoral democracy. And I certainly appreciate that in the U.S., things are in a pretty tough way, as they are in many mature Western democracies. My interest, though, is less about focusing on the institutions of Parliament and Congress, the electoral mechanics, and instead focusing on that space between elections and actually thinking about the capability of citizens to play a much more essential role. After all, deciders take advice from lots of experts. The only way in which we convey public expertise to those deciders are through very thin, very superficial exercises like town hall meetings and surveys. When we invite citizens, in the words of the American pollster Daniel Yankelevich, when we invite people to exercise public judgment, to use their problem-solving capabilities, then we end up getting something, I think, much more valuable, much richer, much more instructive than simply knowing that 48% of people want one thing and 52% of people want the other, which is just an invitation to politicians to then drive those wedge and play the margins.
If you're going to pick one recommendation that came out, I would love to sort of see that maybe even off the air. Where can people find out more, Peter? Where can people learn about what you've been working on?
The best place to go is commissioncanada.ca, and you'll find the reports of the three citizens' assemblies there. And if you want to learn more about this work, just Google citizens' assemblies and OECD for the Organization on Economic Cooperation and Development.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The answer to democracy might be more democracy. Doesn't necessarily mean more politicians. Appreciate people engaging in that, listening to that. And we talk about democracy, and very often what we mean is politics. Now, lots of overlap, and my purpose here is not semantics. And I think very often to save democracy, it means caring about politics. When I use the words differently. When I say they're not, I personally say they're not synonymous. It is that democracy is the people are in charge. That's what I mean. I think that's what it means, right? Demos is the people. And we want our crassy not be the Plutos or the oligos. We want the demos with the people to be in charge. And that has morphed in ancient Greece. That was not, there weren't major elections for who got to be in the Roman Senate or in the Greek democracy legislative body. In ancient Greece, they did it by lot. And of course, that lot was limited, to be clear. We're not merely trying to go back a couple thousand years. It was limited to landowning males of, you know, essentially white but Greek origin. But that mechanism that everybody was in on it, that this wasn't, democracy wasn't something that was done to you, it was done something with you and by you, as well as for you, of the people, for the people and by the people. Now, we built an electoral system. Even that electoral system selected a president at the beginning of this country, not by direct popular vote. The idea was to select a president by the legislative bodies. And we said, no, it's too easily for them to be corrupted, so let's direct vote. Now what we're seeing is with so much dough spent on our elections, that doesn't always seem like democracy. That our politics doesn't always seem like democracy. So how do we get to democracy that works? I do believe there's ways we have to change our politics. By democracy, it's power of the people. Politics, those are the mechanisms by which we manage power so the decision can be made. Managing power so decisions can be made is very important. A nice thing about the citizens' assemblies, a nice thing about a potentially powerful thing about sortition, that's the sort of academic word for it. By selecting by lottery, as Malcolm Gladwell talked about it, by citizen jury, as others have talked about it. Healthy democracy, I think, calls them citizen juries mostly. Citizen assemblies, as they've been called in Canada, is that you can have democracy with a little more protection from the politics. That's the idea about judicial appointments. Of course, politics has seeped in. And to be clear, I think there would be ways which politics would seep in to citizens' assemblies as well. But I think if we're going to save democracy, that means, I think, figuring out a way for us to get together, not just 40% of us, not just 48% of us, not just 51% of us, but closer to consensus, two-thirds or better, pro-democracy coalition.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
If you were going to panel a citizen assembly, if you were going to try to get democracy to answer a question, what question would you want to answer? Where do you think people, not just at the click of a button, but impaneled and informed and having a chance to engage their sober second sense and have a chance to discuss and debate in civil fashion with others, where do you think that we the people might be able to add value? I'd be curious. Let's talk about what's happening in the political world, not just democracy, but in the political world, because there's a lot. So we now know as we talked about yesterday, that Donald J. Trump, former president of the United States, has announced his reelection bid and filed to run for president of the United States. Now, I said in the speculation that when there are those, wait a minute, after the elections, after people were blaming him for Republicans not taking the Senate and having a narrow majority in the House, Republicans will control the House. How could he possibly announce now? Isn't this the worst time? He's coming off what has been framed as a loss. And my explanation was and is, he had to. That in fact, his very unpopularity, the very resistance to him, the fact that there's more and more Republicans in power, are exactly why he had to announce now. The very fact that he's facing indictments is why he had to announce now. He couldn't wait. There is no good news for him to wait politically. Nothing that would make him stronger. Only things that could make him weaker. And now he has a chance to get out ahead of the race. The race is used on purpose, not just like because it's horses, but you actually have to race for things. You have to race for support. You have to race for money. Race for endorsements. You have people like Lindsey Graham coming out, tweeting yesterday. Well, if he keeps sounding like that, he's going to be tough to beat. That was a Lindsey Graham version of a Twitter endorsement. He gets all his myrmidons activating, starting to threaten anybody as anti-conservative, anti-right-wing, anti-MAGA, if they don't fall in line. That he had to. We know now. We also know that it was timed with the testimony of the former chief financial officer, former financial chief of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, that Weisselberg testified yesterday. And I wasn't able to find out when that was scheduled. And we know it was scheduled to happen yesterday. I don't know when they picked that day. I did some research and we knew it was going to be roughly early this week. So it was going to be around the time Trump did it. But this was the most important testimony, the most important news. This guy has real facts about the allegedly fraudulent enterprise that is the Trump Organization. The move now that I wanted to flag is that Donald Trump has one of his tricks in his bag. One of his main tricks is that he holds in a little bottle the stuff that he knows is news potent, the headlines that can't be avoided, the mean things he could say that have to be responded to, and he uses those. He shoots those news bullets at a time when he's worried something else might garner attention. I found the timing interesting that he announced on the same day Weisselberg testified. Not because I know that that was in sync, but at least because it reminds us of how he works. I want to equate him to Ross Perot without knocking Ross Perot in a little bit.
To the Tom Hartman program.
What do we know now that we know more about the House and we know more about the presidency? Mr. C from Van Nuys, California. How you doing, Mr. C?
From Compton, California.
Oh, from Compton, even better. Thank you.
Yeah. Donald Trump does not, how can we allow the biggest criminal in our country to run for office? It doesn't make any sense at all. We already know he's a criminal. I don't care what the courts may say. Everybody knows he's a criminal. His daughter knows, his niece knows, everybody knows he's a criminal.
His chief financial officer knows, his former fixer knows.
He should not be allowed to run for office.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my rant for the day.
Mr. C, do you think, and this is not a rhetorical question, do you think that a majority of Republican voters in early primary states know?
That he's a criminal?
Yeah.
Yeah, and people know, you know, they think that a criminal, because he got money, they think that he knows. He don't know anything.
So you're saying
when he was in office.
The question I'm asking, of course, is will the Republican Party hold him accountable? Will Republican voters hold him accountable? Will Republican voters keep him from being the Republican nominee? Or will they do as they've done the last two presidential elections, with, which is to pick him to carry their flag? I think that's the question we're going to be watching for. Mr. C, I appreciate your call so much.
Yeah, well, I know that there's people who would support him.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that majority of people support him.
And I, of course, hope you're right. And thank you, Mr. C from Compton. And I actually have questions about, you know, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I have questions about some of the irregularities. My own impression of why he started calling out irregularities is because he was trying to do them. Okay, that's what I think. I think it was the one who smelt it, dealt it, was what I think was going on. But he didn't win the last time, and he didn't, and his team hasn't won its congressional elections the way they wish they would have, but the, certainly not their Senate elections this time. But, you know, be careful what you wish for. Let's go to Curtis from Phoenix, Arizona. How you doing, Curtis?
So far, so good, my man. So far, so good. I'm a pessimist because I don't think Trump will get indicted.
Yeah.
One of the reasons, one of the reasons is that he's put sycophants in position to blunt investigations. You got Clarence Thomas sitting on the Supreme Court that nobody challenged. Well, they challenge him, but what are they going to do? It's the way our system is set up. And it's talk about white privilege. If you got money, you can, I mean, you can get away with murder. You can if you got the right attorneys who, but Trump doesn't pay these attorneys. But, I just don't think he has the. I think he has the support system.
No, the support structure.
From getting,
yeah, the support structure is an important element. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. Honored to be with you. We're talking about what we need to learn. It's still debrief week, right? What did we learn about the election? And if you've got thoughts, if you've got races, right? We've announced a few of them here. We announced that Kevin McCarthy has been named as a standard bearer to be Speaker of the House. That doesn't mean, by the way, that he is a cinch to be. I think he probably will be confirmed to be Speaker. I think they'll have, you know, what the projection is 221 Republican votes, so they'll have a three-vote margin. But it's a hard thing, and you could have holdouts. You could have, you know, what Matt Gaetz said as well, in order to be Speaker, Kevin McCarthy is going to have to get yes votes out of people he hasn't been able to get yes votes out of for 5 years. So you could have holdouts. You could have a few people who are holdouts, but they'd still have to have a compromise pick. They'd still have to have somebody they want instead. And it's unclear whether anybody can get the votes in the Republican caucus the way that Kevin McCarthy can. So I assume he will be Speaker. So we learned that. What else we learned? What race are you paying attention to? What are the things? Somebody called in, and I don't think they could stay, but I wanted to highlight what they were going to tell us, which was Michigan in their redistricting used the citizen assembly system, and really appreciate that. Really appreciate that note. It's in fact one of the reasons I'm inspired by the idea of what Michigan's been doing. If you do redistricting, of course, and I'm setting aside just the question of redistricting. If you do redistricting just in blue states, then you'll see what happened where. Republicans take the House because of gerrymandered, Elbridge Gerry, or gerrymandered districts, badly drawn districts, or strategically drawn districts in Texas and Florida, and nonpartisan vote drawing systems from congressional seats in New York and California, to at least to a greater degree. And the and those differences drove the majority in the U.S. House. That said, the system by which Michigan, a purple state, perfect place to do redistricting reform, perfect place. Purple state should be done nationally, also should be done in purple states for sure. Red states, great too, but if you only do it in blue states, there's a debate about that, to be sure. Unilateral disarmament is different than an arms treaty. So in Michigan, they use a system of citizen assemblies to help shape that. I think it's awesome because we want to give people power over the government. That's the whole purpose. Not just democracy theater that they get to play a small role in, but in fact give each of the human beings out there, each of us, a little bit of, just a tiny bit of power. So we all have a tiny bit of power to help shape this and then call us to service and call us to our sober second sense and help us be better people rather than thinking the only thing we have to do is criticize our adversary. It's not enough. Criticizing people we disagree with can be fun, can be deeply important, but ain't enough. We got to be problem solvers. All right. Let's go to Amma from New York. I think it's Amma. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
Yes, you're pronouncing my name right. I'm just so disgusted with the things that I see on the news.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to thank you for taking my call. I just want to say Donald Trump is, his rhetoric, it's like a masochism on the youth because they follow whatever he says or does. But this is a country, America, of checks and balances, and they're disgracing the Republican race. Especially going back to the pontificating of Lincoln fighting for the slaves, to emancipate the slaves. He fought and galvanized the Civil War. So I don't think that we are representing the truth behind this country and this country's value system. But number one, free the children and leave the bushes and the trees behind. Whether it's Bush, whether it's Cheney, we tried so hard. Cheney, let's let a good example. When are Americans going to come to the point in time of setting an example and speaking the truth? Because that's what makes you important.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Amma. And I like your line, protect the children. And it reminds me of, didn't use precise words, but said the same thing. To be clear, in terms of democracy, the children protecting everybody. It is, in fact, Gen Z voters who, so much so that some of the wackadoos were, and I think I have to call them, it's not a very nice name, but it's kind of what I have to call them, because they were saying, oh, we got to change the voting age, because young voters are holding Republicans to account for removing women's liberties and human civic liberties, for not protecting young people in schools, right? All worried about homelessness without providing homes, and worried about crime without worried about gun crime. I mean, it's just political theater. And young people understand, majority of young people understand that we've got to do a better job with that. We got to do a better job at college costs. We got to do a better job at saving democracy. And so, yeah, protect the children. And it's been in songs. And then they'll protect us. At least we can say thank you. We got a minute. Lou, you got about 40 seconds.
Okay. Hey, I just wanted to make a point here. This election was not the voters saying we like Democrats. This election was the voters saying we do not want Republicans. If Democrats want to win, they need to start representing Americans, and they need to quit talking about compromising with the Republicans, because they always cheat. They always have. They've never kept their end of the bargain.
When you say, are there a couple places? Because it's interesting. Usually, when I hear the opening as you gave it, right? Well, this was not a big pat on the back to Democrats. The next thing I hear is, therefore, they've got to compromise, right? And they got to move to the middle or whatever. Where are the places you think that Democrats can show courage that will also find the center of American lives, whether they're aiming for the center or not? You got 5 seconds.
Let's line up behind Bernie. He gets 85% every time he runs in a primary.
Appreciate the call,
we
Lou.
We need progressives.
Appreciate the call, Lou. You be well. We're going to be right back. This is the Tom Hartman Show.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one?
Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day.
So what makes a life a good one?
In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I am Jefferson Smith, honored to be with you today. We are joined now, somebody I've been grateful for heck, a couple decades now, Justin Krebs, who I knew back in the day when he started drinking liberally and doing other things liberally, who is now the campaign director at MoveOn.org. Justin, can you hear me?
I can hear you. And it's good to hear your voice again through the decades, echoing through the decades.
It's been a long time, man. It's been a long time. So we're talking about what we're grateful for, and including things that haven't received enough ink. And if ink is no longer the parlance, then by whatever medium people consume, hasn't received enough pixels or attention or, I don't know, YouTube videos or TikTok clips. What are people missing, or what are you particularly grateful for coming out of this election?
Well, sure. A few of the things I'm grateful for aren't necessarily going to be shockers. Democrats holding the Senate and looking like we're going to expand the majority in the Senate. So obviously we know that story. But to think that all Democratic incumbents were reelected after what they were able to accomplish over the last 2 years, that's huge. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that we prevented a red wave from materializing. It's not like there was never going to be a red wave. There was a chance of it. It was our voters turning out, our messages resonating. It was huge youth vote, which is something, Jefferson, I know you've cared about for decades, since back when we were youth. But the huge youth vote I'm thankful for, and I want to see that continue through Georgia in the runoff so we can get to 51 Senate seats. And I want to see that continue next year. And I want to see that be a story leading into 2024 as well.
So, Justin, what were some of the campaigns that MoveOn dug into that people might not be aware of? Obviously, I know y'all would have been involved in sort of the key swing Senate races. What are some of the things that MoveOn was paying attention to that people might not be as aware of during the election that ended last Tuesday?
Absolutely, Jefferson. You know, the secretaries of state races. These are the positions that often ride a little bit below the headlines, these down ballot races. Often in many states, they're thought of as almost just nonpartisan folks that run the elections in a meritocratic way. But we saw a whole fleet of election deniers supporting Trump, supporting the insurrection, trying to seize these levers of power. And in state after state, election deniers lost those races. And in state after state, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, we were able to help elect secretaries of state in places like Pennsylvania, the governor, who can make sure that the election continues to take place as it should. So it was really a pro-democracy election in that regard that was based both on races we don't often think about and MoveOn members turning out for those races, making phone calls, sending plenty of text messages, donating directly to those candidates, but also that a pro-democracy message resonated, which is important for our democracy. It's important for our electoral victories, but it's important, also important to fight against MAGA.
No, it's disappointing that a pro-democracy message is something that is persuasive, right? If only because you'd think everybody would already be persuaded, but no, I agree a bunch. What are you up to now? What are the, I assume y'all are working in Georgia. Is now a time of debrief? What happens at MoveOn right after an election?
That's a great question. And even from before Election Day, we were ready to say the election doesn't end on November 8th.
Yeah.
There's the Georgia runoff. There's counting every vote, which has been happening as more and more races have been called. There's preparing for this final session of Congress. So we will take a break at some point, but it is not it's not a rest, despite what we've accomplished. And our members aren't resting. You know, the day after the election, our members started donating directly to Senator Warnock's reelection campaign. He is an excellent senator. Georgia needs him. The Senate needs him. America needs him. And MoveOn members have already donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to his campaign. We had a kickoff for our Georgia work this past Monday. Actually, Mark Hamill joined the call as a live stream.
Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, is that fun? Thousands of MoveOn members joining a call to not just debrief the election, which was historic, but also to look ahead. So we are diving in. We have hundreds of thousands of folks in Georgia that we're able to reach, contact, activate, that we've been in touch with, both in the 2020 election, the 2020 runoff, the 2022 election. So we have a track record there. We collectively as a movement have won Georgia before. Move On has helped support that work, and we're going to do it again in 19 days.
What are the different dynamics in Georgia between a midterm national election where there's a tension everywhere and lots of things in the ballot, governor's race on the ballot there, legislative races, et cetera, and a special election in Georgia? I mean, I named some of them, but what does that change in terms of the electoral math, who comes out to vote, et cetera?
It definitely changes the expectations a lot. You know, you don't have the same sense of a current that you're flowing with. You have to help create that current a little bit. You have to remind folks when they can vote, that early voting exists, that early voting is curtailed by holidays like Thanksgiving and holidays like Robert E. Lee Day, if you can believe it. So early voting is chopped up in ways that are going to make it harder. All the more reason that you need to communicate with every voter you can reach. Move On has a plan. We are going to text, we're going to call, we're going to do polling place vote tripling, where we actually meet people when they're coming out of voting and encourage them to contact their friends live at that moment. We've done this before in Georgia. We're going to do it again. But also in terms of the stakes, you know, there's a chance to reelect a really exceptional senator. Senator Warnock has this moral seriousness, this warmth, this compassion, this humor. He was able to help lower drug prices. He's leading the charge on capping insulin prices. He's a great senator. And it's not just about expanding the Democratic majority, which of course it is. 51 is a world different than 50. But let's elect a really great senator, and let's make sure people know there's a reason to come out yet again. This is the fourth time you're going to be voting for Senator Warnock in 2 years for some folks. Let's do it again and give him the full term.
Yeah, it's supposed to be when you're a senator, you don't have to run all the time. He has to run more than, like, dog catcher. He has to run more than a member of the two-year state legislature. He's always running. Like, Warnock, it doesn't feel fair.
It's exhausting for him. It's exhausting. Well, he'll have 6 years where he gets to work and represent and legislate. But right now, he is, I'm sure, running as hard as he can. We're independent of the campaign, but we're running as hard as we can alongside of him. And, you know, these runoffs, they used to be in January. They were moved up to December. 4 weeks later, we're already 9 days in. That's 19 days. And I don't know what you're doing next week, but a lot of people are going to be checking out of politics, enjoying family time, enjoying Thanksgiving, finding loved ones, doing charity. It's sneaking up on us. It's racing up on us. And so really having everything in motion. And if folks want to get involved, they can go to moveon.org/electWarnock. moveon.org/electWarnock. You can find out about making phone calls. You can find out about vote tripling. And you can find out about how to really raise the stakes of this election.
Is there already something called door knock for Warnock? Has that been used a lot of times?
Not by us.
Well, that feels like a real missed opportunity, man. I mean, it just seems like it's just for those of us who play in the verbal gymnasium, it feels it's just right there waiting to be done, door knock for Warnock. I mean, come on.
That's incredible. And after I'm off this call, I plan on Googling it.
So do I. Let me just ask before we go. What is Move On? We know the origin story of Move On and how it got started. And it was sort of the earliest, maybe, sort of big political email. Mm-hmm. What's the state of Move On? What's the scale of the membership? How many people do you reach out to? And what are the tools do you use other than email these days?
Sure. Well, Move On continues to have millions and millions of members around the country. And including in Georgia, where we're going to play big, where there are hundreds of thousands of folks we'll be able to reach. We've reached over the past few cycles. But this midterm was our largest midterm program that we've run in our 24-year history. A $30 million program to help defend our democracy, to help ensure that folks understand that abortion was on the ballot, to help defend the Democratic Senate and, in fact, expand it. These governor's races, these secretaries of state races. So that's everything from investing in the technology to text folks at scale, to communicate with them where they are, to actually get folks on the ground, and also the direct contributions that our members send to these candidates that we help them learn about.
So email just a second. You had it going there. I didn't want to interrupt you. Finish your sentence, Justin.
Oh, I was just going to say that email still plays a huge role, but obviously it's not only email, thankfully. We keep evolving from there.
Yeah.
But Great talking to you.
No, I mean, I really appreciate your work. I would ask you to, again, tell people how to find MoveOn.org online, but the name sort of gives it away. It's not very much a secret.
It's not too much of a secret. You already said it. And check out MoveOn.org/electWarnock to get involved in calling and vote tripling, or MoveOn.org/nope. to see what we have to say about Donald Trump.
Or hashtag doorknock for Warnock. All right, Justin, thanks a bunch, man.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon. Have a great week.
Be well. Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Lee from Sepulveda, California.
Hi, yeah. I want to talk about a paradigm shift from what we basically have as white supremacists versus all non-whites. That's kind of the paradigm that we've been in for hundreds of years. I want to say that constitutional government is a demand for nonviolence. The split I want to make, rather than the white supremacist, colored non-whites, is violence and a commitment to nonviolence. That people of all colors in this nation are committed to nonviolence, but there are some who are just committed to violence. That's the split that we need to make. And then I want to say one other thing about racism, that it's to be treated as a disease. Yeah. But before 1953, that's appropriate. But since the uncovering of the double helix, where all life is comes from the same foundation, and then there's 23 paired chromosomes, which are human. It's always been that way, no matter what you look like, what your color, anything. If you have 23 paired chromosomes and your parents do, you're a human, period. And that ends racism. The only way you can have racism is if you have two races. We don't. We only have one.
Appreciate it, Lee. Thanks for the call. Let's go straight to Jim from Phoenix, Arizona. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, you guys are preaching just perfect with the segue. Yes, in Genesis it says, I created one race, the human race. It's that simple. He said it with the double helix, and that's what it is. And I'm grateful for everything. I'm grateful that the price has been paid, the sacrifice has been made. You see, we need to start loving each other, and why have the executions? Why have the lines? Why are we the biggest warring nation in the world? We've got some serious problems to deal with, but I am so thankful that people like you and your friends, everybody's starting to see it. We don't need all them books. We can write one in our head right now, and you've been doing it, and I thank you very much, Jefferson. Later.
Jim, thanks a million. It was a great call. I'm grateful for this community, and it's not just Pablum. I mean, it is... I'll have to say this again. I'll just say it a little bit later in the show. Remind me if I don't. Sometimes I forget stuff. I want to talk about the power, the potential power of this community, potential power of your show, the Tom Hartman Show, and what could be wrought. This is Jeff. This is Tom's show. This is your show.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And welcome to the Tom Hartman University Book Club. Today we're reading an excerpt from Robert Wolf's book, Original Wisdom, Stories of an Ancient Way of Knowing. I wrote the foreword for it. Robert Wolf died in Hawaii. Louise and I visited him there a number of times. He was in his 90s. And back in the 1950s, he was an anthropologist and sociologist who had been hired by the Malaysian government to figure out why this one particular Aboriginal tribe, the Senoi, who lived deep inside the jungle, hunting-gathering tribe, why they were, quote, lazy, why they were unwilling to work at the rubber plantations. And he got to know them, and he discovered that their view of the world was completely different than ours. And that's essentially what this book is about, and it's absolutely a mind-boggling book. I'll share a little. This is from the middle of the book. This is page 86. It's finally he's reached the point where they'll let him sleep in the village with them. He says, in time, I grew to know them better. But it was when I began to overnight in their villages that I learned that they literally lived in another reality. When it became dark, people huddled together for warmth and companionship. In the tropics, there's no long period of dusk. It grows dark quickly. The air would become cool, and people would move closer together, reaching out, touching a neighbor, perhaps holding hands. Women might run their fingers through the hair of the person sitting next to them. During the nights I stayed over, they would often gather around me and have me ask them questions. Then they would ask me questions, very quietly and softly. Our being together was not like other social situations I'd ever experienced. We talked, but softly. They did not know how to compete for attention. A few words now and then were all that were spoken, a question or a comment, a simple answer, long silences. Sometimes someone would have some tobacco and light a cigarette, a tobacco rolled into a leaf, which was passed around the group. People might ask each other whether they had noticed that particularly bright patch of sunlight on the side of the river behind a certain tree, or if they had noticed that large yellow bird that sang in the morning. Evening was a time of reflection, of gentle communication, of being together. I never knew their blood relationships, but evening times felt like family. As it grew later, one of the people would get up to go into one of the houses, more often little more than lean-tos or rickety huts on stilts, and fall asleep. Eventually, each of us had found an empty spot on the floor of one of the shelters, and wrapped in our sarongs, we huddled close to whoever else slept in that house that night. The houses did not belong to anyone. It seemed that each of the four or five little shelters was for all the people living in that settlement at that moment. We would fall asleep whenever we chose, and, I'm sure, with whomever we wanted to spend the night. Yes, people had sex, but even that was gentle, quiet, and discreet. Occasionally, someone might turn over and bump into a couple being a little too acrobatic or noisy, and there would be a grunt, or people might move away from a couple that made too much to do about their lovemaking. Passionate lovemaking between young people often took place during the day, outside in a more hidden spot in the jungle, I was told. In the morning, we might not all wake up at the same time, but those who woke up early would lay quietly, waiting for more people to awaken. And somehow, as if by magic, we would find ourselves sitting in a circle, rubbing our eyes, stretching the kinks out. One person would say, I saw a bird, a beautiful bird. Someone else would say, yes, I too saw a bird. What kind of bird was it? Another would ask. And so they would create a story with images from our dreams. They did not think that they were sharing dreams as we think of dreams. The Sonoy believe that the world we live in is a shadow world and that the real world is behind it. At night, they believe, we visit the real world. In the morning, we share what we saw and learned there. The story that was created around the memories that four or five people brought back from the real world set the tone for that day. Sometimes one of the group would take the lead in soliciting input from each person in the room. How about you? What do you remember? Other times, the story flowed without help. A few times, no story emerged at all. It was very obvious that when a more or less coherent story was created around the images we shared, we who had slept in that shelter would live that story that day. Usually the stories were simple. A bird had shown the way to a tree that was bearing fruit. Later that day, some of us would find that tree, and of course it did have ripe fruit. Or the story was about a bad storm, so people would stay close to the shelters all day, and yes, there was a big storm in the late afternoon. Occasionally the stories were about things that affected all of them, all the people in the settlement, or perhaps even all the Sonoy. In that case, they would make it a point to share with the people who had slept in other shelters as soon as possible. It might take all morning to disseminate that story to everyone. I did not witness any attempts to call a meeting, but it was obvious that when a serious story came out of a morning's dream telling, all the people in the settlement would eventually hear that story. I learned about all of this very early during the time that I spent with the Sonoy. It was in what I thought of as the first village, the first settlement I visited, that an important story emerged from what I brought back from the real world during one of my nights there. It made a big impression on me because part of the story came from my dream. It was a particularly vivid dream about one of my family's dogs, an all-black mongrel that seemed to have come with the house we rented in the suburbs of Kuala Lumpur. We had tried to get rid of that dog. In fact, one of the first days after we moved in, we had run over the poor dog in the driveway, but he would not leave. We tried chasing him away. He kept coming back. So we adopted him and called him Jaga, which is Malay for guard or protector. I do not remember that Jaga was a particularly good watchdog, but he was around. And he goes on to tell his dream. And then it's just an absolutely fascinating book from Robert Wolf's Original Wisdom.
So who is Donald Trump like? What is this presidential campaign shaping up to be like? Are there any historical analogs? What do we know? Well, we know a few things about the data. And I broke this down. Borowitz had a funny headline, you know, Donald Trump seeks unprecedented third impeachment. Relatively funny headline. What are the criteria? How do we evaluate this race? I did it in a couple ways. I actually three. I looked at some of the polling. Polling's close. Donald Trump is not dominating the Republican primaries. Okay, he is. He and DeSantis are pretty close in key early states. Betting markets give him about a better chance than anybody else, but give him right now about a one-third chance at getting the nomination. So I looked at that kind of data. Second thing I did is break down by kind of analytical category. And if, as for instance, so I mentioned polling, mentioned betting markets. Look at his team. Will he be able to organize in the states? The best people might not go with him. I looked at ways that he might have gotten stronger and weaker, essentially, than the last time. Now, one might say he's stronger than he was. He's not strong, and just in the Republican primary, mind you. I'm not talking about the general election, just the Republican primary. He is, of course, not stronger than he was when he was a sitting president. They shut down the primaries so that he could have essentially no opposition. The question is, I'm comparing this now to 2016, forgive me. There are some ways he's stronger. He has now been president. He's actually proved that he was at the beginning of the campaign. He'd never been president. He has shown that he could win, sort of, couldn't win the popular vote, but could be elected, named, sworn in as president of the United States. He has now figured out more who his allies and enemies are. That could make him a little stronger. He might be able to lock up some money, lock up some teams that might be able to, that might have gone elsewhere, having been the standard bearer two times in a row. There's some ways he's weaker. So many of the institutionalists don't want to be with him. Heck, Ivanka and Jared don't want to be with him as they try to re-burnish themselves. Here's one. He's not as fresh and interesting anymore. It's not, you know, the joke is more stale. It's not a, wow, look at that. We've kind of looked at that for a while. They're looking for, look for the quarter milk in the fridge. It's a little fresher. People on their side are ready for some of his stuff. They're used to the nicknames. They're used to him poking at people. They're used to him saying extreme, wacky things. After the invasion of Ukraine, Russian influence might be weaker. There's been some crackdown on accounts. Heck, setting that aside, but Donald Trump is no longer on Twitter or Facebook. That probably makes him weaker. He's also been impeached two times, and he's under multiple investigations now. That might make him weaker. So I looked at some of that stuff, and then I looked a little bit at the. He's older now, right? He's in his late 70s, and that doesn't mean that he's disqualified to be president, to be sure. But he might not have the same energy he had. He might not be as strong generally in social media. There might be fewer people that kind of want to associate with him. So that's one, the sort of second area I look. First, data, then sort of stronger, weaker in categories. And then third, I looked at history. I looked at historical analogs. Donald Trump might be one of the following seven or eight people. He might follow or might learn something from following seven or eight trends. I'll finish with this today. He might be Ross Perot, not as fresh or interesting anymore, and with a power structure that is more ready to block him. It could be him versus DeSantis might be like Reagan challenging Gerald Ford, where Reagan gets famous but Ford loses. He might be Martin Van Buren. Martin Van Buren lost and later ran as a third-party candidate. He wanted to preserve his power and relevance. But Van Buren was a party builder. Right? That's who he was. Donald Trump was a Trump builder. Teddy Roosevelt, he'd like to be maybe Teddy Roosevelt, except Teddy Roosevelt, out of the limelight, tried to return and challenge Taft. But that helped turn the Republican Party, who had turned the Republican Party conservative, and the progressives and Teddy Roosevelt wanted the Republican Party to be progressive again, at least briefly. Roosevelt ended up running the strongest third-party campaign to date, getting second in both the popular and electoral votes, beating the Republican, but not winning. U.S. Grant tried to come back, not after losing, though, but after serving two terms. He led in the polls, but the delegates at the convention, kind of like Teddy Roosevelt, wouldn't give him the Republican Party nomination. He might be Hoover. Hoover lost to FDR, became much more conservative, then tried to run back again after losing in 1932, tried to run again in 1940, but he seemed like old news, and he lost to Wendell Willkie. His hope is he'll be like Grover Cleveland, who won, served, lost, came back to run, and won. He's the only president to do that. Not only, though, then I wanted to note that Grover Cleveland had the moral authority of having won the popular vote when he lost. I think that's that analog is some of what's behind, whether he knows the history or not, Trump's claims to have actually won that election. So he has that rhetorical wind at his back. I don't see Donald Trump as the favorite in the Republican, or at least not by a mile. He's the leading name, but I don't see him as the odds-on winner in the Republican primary. He could win. I would pick him above anybody else head-to-head, but it's not head-to-head. There's going to be a big race ahead. And don't think, therefore, that Donald Trump is the only thing to be concerned about. Democracy is the thing we've got to be concerned about. We're here not because to fight or support any given human being, but to support humanity, support democracy. That's the team we're on. I appreciate y'all. You're priceless. Worth a lot, not for sale. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jefferson Smith. This is your show.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.